Yes, so broad deflation of food, it's breakthrough. So at this chart, it's a little bit complex, but I think it's worth understanding. Inflation was still around almost up until December 2019. That's all the bad year, like FE 5 year, 3 year, all that. And then goes through to April 2024, we'll see. And then the next slide is the next sort of year holds a most recent months. So we can really see within this year, 3 year, there's been the worst inflation. Okay. But actually, the last 12 months, the deflation throughout most categories. It was very low inflation on deflation until 2029, as from 2019. And so, yeah, we're sort of back to normal, so to speak, there. I even did a bit of for us in all the South Africa, so bringing back to the normal levels. But largely, have back. The next chart there is that inflation. So it's still a story there. What's the deflation right at not be? The rest of you rates are a bit of a burst of inflation at the moment, but they require to fade up your price turnaround. Energy does make a big difference. But most central banks sort of tend to spread that out. But for the goods, just broad based deflation everywhere throughout goods. There's a slight tick up in the last 3 months in terms of apparel and questions in the last month over that, but it's tariff issues going through, but by and large, you know, it was deflation, maybe that inflation. Where it's really struck though with services, and that's the part where a couple of major categories. Now I go over to the trial sort of get saying, and it's no, you take out insurance, you take out cars, then you don't get any inflation. Because whatever you used to complain, it's usually a couple categories still brought. But I think that the main thing to note, how's the shelter played a huge role? And at least then, what we're looking at there is that the housing shelter is, in most rich period, it's had a little bit of tick up. But all the board indicators, all the private surveys, everything like that,
I think it's also worth
then a lot of that insurance catch up. So for example, we're seeing that the insurance for motor vehicles because been crisis for second-hand motor vehicles, all that stress catching up and those prices. And they actually seeing price falls in all these bud boots. Now, the insurance way and get that sort of old to be granted. So yes, there's certain definitely in it. So there's still inflation is still the struggle. There's reasons to be feel like that he's got it through. But I think it's the main back in the area wait. I'll get back to you, Dave.
Okay, so a couple of points I would say. As Damo suggested, the three columns are quite useful. So it's sort of pre-COVID was normal. Well, it was a low inflation period. Then you've got the COVID period up to April 24 with goods service inflation going nuts. And if you look at the last few months, even though we've been seeing, something of a pop in some areas, the goods area of inflation has actually been improving over the last 3 months. Now, it's still falling. It's just not falling as quickly as hoped. And the main reason for that is, as Damo suggested, was the housing segment. And that is dominated by something called OER, which is owner's implied rent, owner's equivalent rent. And it's simply there are methodological differences between a lot of the private indices that are real time and between the BLS, which is official inflation. And you can see they do track one another, but for the time being, the official one is lagging what is, you know, very rapidly falling disinflation in that segment that will continue. So this is why the Federal Reserve, even during the recent Q1 pop in inflation, was quite confident that it was not going to have to raise rates. The only thing that the Fed did during that period was talk about, you know, the possible delays to rate cuts. So we had Fed futures markets flopping around, going from anything up to six cuts down to one. At the moment, we're sitting at about two. But the bottom line is OER is going to fall, and it's going to fall a lot further. And that's going to go a long way to getting the Fed towards its target. And the Fed knows this, obviously. So this is why I think the Fed has remained, has basically used the jawbone through the last 3 months instead of using the cash rate. As a way of either tightening or loosening. It's just been jawboning markets. We're dovish, we're less dovish, waiting for the confidence to cut. But the phrase waiting for the confidence to cut tells you where they're at. Like, they do not expect anything to come through that would force them to hike again. All they're doing is waiting for these official measures to catch down to reality so that they can begin their loosening regime. Now, in the US, there are reasons to think that inflation will remain higher than it did pre-COVID. The first being something we've discussed many times, which is a structural shortage of labor. And so their wages growth should stay higher than it did in the pre-COVID period. And goods inflation and wages inflation are just like tied at the hip. So I'm not saying that US inflation is about to go straight back to the low inflation period. I don't think it is, because I think their wages growth will remain higher than it was pre-COVID. And so some of these goods items will remain a little warmer as well. But there's plenty more disinflation ahead in the US. Q1 is always the worst in the US. It's always the worst. And so even despite the fact that the BLS seasonally adjusts it, it's still always the worst. And post-COVID, all of these bureaus of statistics have been struggling to seasonally adjust their CPIs appropriately, like, because COVID just disrupted all of their formulas for calculating seasonal adjustments. So I'm not saying that PCE, which inflation, the Fed's favorite measure, is about to drop to 2%, but if it gets anywhere near 2.5%, which it looks like it will by the end of the year, it will see that as inflation victory, and it will begin to cut and assume that inflation will continue to fall. Like, you don't fatten the pig on market day, or you end up overshooting to the downside. So I think at this stage, right now I'd say two cuts from the Fed is a fair assessment for this year, but we get another month or so of the OER coming back into line, then that could easily go back up to four cuts. You know, like, that's how sensitive interest rates are right now to particular segments of inflation in the US. So at this stage with the US, I believe there will be some cuts this year as OER comes off, and I think that the risks are actually tilted to the downside for more than that. but I'm happy to say they will begin an easing cycle at the end of this year. Basically, there's quite a bit of data in the last few weeks in the US that is showing that the economy, during the inflation pop in this first quarter, markets got very excited about this idea that there'd be no landing whatsoever in the US, and that the Fed wouldn't either cut at all and quite possibly hike again. And we saw this reflected in yields and spreads, but that was basically just overreaction. There was panic. There was a lumpy quarter, which is nearly always the first quarter in the US. So I think that the US disinflation is still in track. The Fed is tight enough. Each year that goes past from here, there's a lot of tightening that happens in the US automatically because so much of the debt in the corporate sector was durationed out during COVID. But each year that goes forward, all of that durationed out debt starts to reset to the higher rates. And so if the Fed doesn't cut, it will be tightening, right, for business. And that process begins next year and then runs right up to like 2028, when you're going to get some really big kind of resets in bond yields for corporations. And so what has been a tailwind will turn headwind. So the Fed has very good reasons to begin an easing cycle. It won't be a dramatic cycle. I don't think it'll be slow and steady, because I would expect to see lumpy quarters again, like we've just had in Q1. So, however, the trend is down in the US. Now that takes you to what is the neutral interest rate in the US? So how far down would rates come? I personally think that the neutral interest rate, which is, you know, that rate where they balance employment and inflation, is a little higher than it was pre-GFC because of the labor shortages, but not massively so. And, you know, in the pre-GFC period, pre-COVID period, we were really talking about minus interest rates as being the neutral rate, right? So I think that the US bond yields could come down considerably from where they are, down to sort of, say, on the 10-year, down to 2.5% or so over the next, say, 2 years. So I think there's plenty of upside in bonds in the US as this transpires. And I will add, again, lumpy, like we've seen in the first quarter. You'll get pops of inflation here and there, especially from geopolitics and oil, which will, you know, like with the various wars going on, come up and down. Also, like if we were to have a change of administration in the US, that would throw a real curveball into this, because the amount of tariffs that Trump is mulling for China could potentially be a one-off, rather large inflation shock for the US. You know, that would be lumpy for a couple of quarters if that transpired as well. So, but generally speaking, the Fed has disinflation on track. You know, it's slow and it's steady and it's lumpy, but I think it'll get there.
We'll be back with the investment insights very shortly. Nucleus Wealth is an active and passive investment manager. If you like what you're hearing and want some help with the investing, we can do it for you via our active portfolios. Our tactical and core portfolios use the insights shared in this podcast to construct and manage your investment. We blend tactical portfolios to offer our combinations of international shares, Australian shares, government bonds, and cash. We vary the asset allocation with the goal of protecting your capital in times of market uncertainty. We also have active international and Australian share portfolios. These are chosen using our quality and value investment philosophy. You can find out more at nucleuswealth.com. Now back to the show.
So we're back. And so So that's a background of, you know, sort of broadly and slowly declining bond yields, sovereign bond yields I'm talking about here as a context for Australia. Now, the Australian inflation mix is very, very different to the US. It's almost the complete opposite. So in Australia, we've never had wage inflation get, we've managed to just grovel above 4%. And all of our inflation basically came from massive policy errors by the government. So the first one was the Ukraine war, and it allowed the international gas price to percolate back to Australia instead of protecting us from it, which would have been the easiest thing in the world to do, and which it actually did do eventually, but 8 months too late. And what that meant was that the gas price, which drives the electricity price in Australia, had crossed through a period where regulators set the price for electricity through the year ahead, which meant they'd turned a 6 month gas international gas shock into an 18 month electricity shock in Australia. And I think that it's really underestimated how much that has percolated absolutely everything, because power, you know, obviously is a massive input into all sorts of things, especially manufacturing services as well, though. And unfortunately, this has converged with the second policy error, which was the federal government massively overcooked bringing in migrants when they reopened borders. And so we went from having, you know, negative population growth to having something like 600,000 people pour in over a year. Now, I think reopening the borders and allowing temporary workers back in was a good idea. But, you know, 200,000 would have been fine. 600,000, you know, is ridiculous. We'll probably do 350 the year after and maybe eventually get down to 260, which is now the official target. And so what that's done is the opposite of the US, where it's absolutely slaughtering Australian wages. I'll come back to that point. What I'll first point out is having so many people come in so quickly on the back of COVID created inflation hotspots wherever the migrant communities were touching upon. And so I've circled those here. This is the monthly inflation indicator, which through January to April, as you can see on the left-hand side, has basically just been stuck at 3.5%, hasn't budged. Now, this is despite the fact that we've had good goods deflation, food inflation started to come off at a pretty good clip. Recreation and culture has been cheap. Transport's been up and down. Communications have been disinflationary. But anything that the migrants touch, and this is not to blame the migrants, this is the government's fault. So housing, health, and education. So education is a massive pipeline for migrants in Australia. So it's got rent on inflation because there's just not enough of anything. There's a huge externality in Australian education, which is they simply don't build enough accommodation for the students that they have coming in. And so what that's done is put enormous pressure on Australian housing, both in terms of capital values, but in particular in terms of rents. Now, so that housing segment that I've circled there, that's 20% of the CPI that's been running at 5, 6, 7, 8% throughout this last 6 month period. And of course, you know, everybody needs health services, and so they're all overloaded. So what's happened is Australia has too quickly grown its population without the appropriate capital investment. And so capital is basically all the things that you have in your economy that, you know, that are fixed and make it work. So it's anything from a hospital to a factory, to infrastructure, whatever. That's your capital base. And what we've done is put too many people on into our capital base and created these inflation hotspots where too fast immigration has created endemic inflation. So we never needed to have the inflation shock. We just didn't need to have it. We didn't need to have the gas price, and we didn't need to do this immigration play that was so strong that created endemic inflation in things that are very large components of the CPI. So moving on to the next chart, that's the bad news. The bad news is that we've got these very difficult to resolve hotspots. Now, the federal government, in its wisdom, has finally panicked and realized that it's massively screwed up energy and massively screwed up immigration. So it's trying to fix energy with big investments into gas, but it hasn't actually fixed the problem. What it's done is put a very high price cap on gas, which still enables electricity to run at very high levels. So that cap is nowhere near low enough. And it's opening up, or trying to open up, areas for new gas investment to try and get more supply in. But it's done that without really curtailing the LNG export sector that takes what is an incredible abundance of cheap gas in Australia and sends it all to China and Japan, but mostly China. So what they're doing instead to help alleviate the inflationary impacts is they're doing bill subsidies, and there were more of these that were introduced in yesterday's budget, where they're giving business and households just cash handouts to offset the extraordinary price rises in their utility bills. Now, in the short term, that's actually a reasonable policy, because it certainly wasn't business and households' fault that Vladimir Putin decided to cut the gas flows off from Europe. However, they're hiding behind it without fixing the structural problems that are causing it. And so in the case of energy, what they've established effectively is an energy subsidy that just passes through your bill direct to the gas companies that are the real problem. So the real answer is to keep more Australian gas in Australia, but there's nobody in government that has the courage to even contemplate doing that kind of serious national interest policy. So I suspect bill subsidies are going to be the way of the future. So anyway, that has helped Australian inflation come down quite a lot. We're down to about 4%. A lot of that was energy. And that leaves us with housing and services as the sort of hot areas that now need to be addressed. Now, there's simply not going to be enough housing. We're not going to build enough. One of the unfortunate side effects of the energy shock was that it's a huge cost component that goes into building materials, for instance. So in the making of bricks, tiles, plasterboard, you name it, energy is an enormous component of cost in all of those things. So the cost of building a house has gone so high, it's actually higher than what you can sell it for. And so builders can't build, basically. There's no profits in it. And so the housing crisis has been made basically permanent, and unless they either slash immigration to next to zero to take demand off, or they somehow start to subsidize even more these building construction firms. So what that means is we're probably looking at a period of inflation in Australia that is higher, also higher than the pre-COVID period. based on those immigration touch points that the federal government simply has no structural policies to address. So, I don't know where inflation settles, but, you know, what was it? It was hovering below 2% before COVID. We're probably talking, you know, it gets stuck more at 2.5 now and stays there until resolution is found for these problems. And there's no obvious resolution coming. However, there's a good news, bad news story that goes with this. And that is, like the US, Australia has also had very strong services inflation, as well as these touch points from immigration that I've mentioned. That's part of a large part of services, but there's broader categories such as insurance and things that Damien's been mentioning about the US. What Australia has done with this massive immigration surge is kill wage growth at the same time. So I've got a chart up here which just shows you the unemployment rate versus the job the number of applications per job, and you can see they generally track each other pretty well. And at the moment, the number of applications per job is now almost at COVID shock levels when nobody had a job. Whereas the unemployment rate has belly climbed. We've had our unemployment out this morning, and it has jumped again up to 4.5%, and I would expect that to continue through to 5% at least. It depends how quickly they slow immigration, but I wouldn't be surprised to see 6% unemployment in Australia within the next 12 months. And moreover, underemployment is a huge problem with this economic model. So what it means is incomes are really constrained for 60 or 70% of the economy that is workers making money, and they've all basically been in per capita recession for 2 years, almost without respite, with falling real wages. So that's very disinflationary for services, because people are stuck buying essentials, discretionary goods are under a lot of pressure, or discretionary services. And so, again, wages and services, because wages are such a large input cost into services, tend to track each other very closely. And so the good news here for Australia and inflation, I'll just scroll through a couple of charts here. You can see I've actually done state by state images on the rise. Hang on, where are we? People on this chart pack. There are state by state looks at the rise of applicants and what have you. But anyway, if you scroll through far enough in this chart pack, you'll find a chart that shows you this brilliant relationship between services inflation and labor costs in Australia. And you'll see that labor costs have already materially accelerated below services costs. Wages growth at the moment in Australia is sitting at what, Damo? Can you remember wages? Is it roughly 4.1, I think. But on a quarter-by-quarter basis, it's almost down at 3. I expect it will be approaching 2 within 6 months. There's that much surplus labor that isn't being picked up by the Bureau of Economics. And so goods inflation's coming down. Is the story here in Australia as well. And so with Australian inflation sitting up at around 4% and big wage deflation ahead, despite the fact that we've got these immigration hotspots for immigration, we're going to see headline and core inflation come down further, a lot further. So again, a similar story to the US, because the structure of policy is not ideal. It means I don't think we'll get as low as we were down to the 2% range, but I do think that the RBA will be well and truly back under a 3. You remembering that the RBA's upper bound is 3, whereas the US upper bound is 2. We don't have to work quite so hard. I think that the RBA will be back down into 3 with ease over the next 6 months, and will also be cutting rates. Now, there's another very good reason for them to cut rates, which I'm not sure that they'd fully grasp at this point, and it's not something that I would ever really endorse normally, and that is the moment you cut rates in Australia, house prices go up. And why that's important right now is if house prices start to rise, then builders will start to be able to build homes again. Now, that sounds slightly inflationary, and it probably is, but it's also deflationary because it will start to take a lot of pressure off rents. So we'll have falling immigration, rising building, so more on the supply side, and falling wages and rising house prices. Where is the neutral interest rate in all that is anybody's guess. It will be higher than it was pre-COVID, but I think it's plausibly, you know, again, down around 2-2.5%. And so again, I see like big falls ahead over the next year and a half for sovereign yields in Australia, very similar to the US. Like, I don't think there's anything that is atypical enough in Australia for it to diverge from the disinflationary environment in the US. So on that basis, I think both economies are going to disinflate over the next 6 to 12 months at a pretty good clip. Again, lumpy, which we've said from the start, but I don't think that we're stuck in a structural inflation crisis, barring, you know, a new war in the Middle East, or some kind of blockade of the Straits of Hormuz, whatever you want to call it. I think we're headed for, I guess, not the lowflation period again, but probably a period not that far above it. And then if you look at the sort of broad sweep of what's driving global growth over the next few years, where the heat is going in terms of capital, which will start to sort of have an effect over the next year or two. We look at things like autonomous cars, artificial intelligence, weight loss drugs. These are enormous structural technologies that we see flowing through over the next full business cycle. And all of them are productivity enhancing, employment destroying, cost lowering in terms of, you know, the mechanization of transport. And so once you get through this period of squeezing out what's left of inflation, addressing, you know, the various shortages that we've got with our immigration-led model, then there's a wave of investment coming in behind this stuff. That is all very deflationary. So this is not the 1970s. I don't see having squeezed out, say, 2/3 of the inflation spike, we're suddenly going to turn around and race back up again, barring a geopolitical shock, which I don't particularly see coming. Then I think we get back to somewhere around a lowflationary normal steadily over time. Now, at that point, the policy challenges and personal investment challenges will swing very sharply from worrying about inflation to worrying about getting a job. You know, because if you have transport losing jobs en masse to automation, you have administration, media, banking, any of the, basically the entire services sector shedding jobs through AI up to sort of 20-30% of jobs over a 5 to 10 year period. And then you have weight loss drugs that are raising participation in the labor force because you have a lot less illness. You have a lot more people able to work because it's so good for the health of everybody as those drugs expand out into use on all sorts of maladies. At the moment, they're relatively narrow, their application, but they will broaden out because it makes so much sense for everyone to be thinner. Then you go from, what will be a sort of normal-ish inflationary environment, I think, back into the low-flation era. So the next cycle looks like more low-flation to me, maybe with disruptions that we didn't see through the 10 years up to 2020, because obviously the world's a little more fractious and, there are possible issues with oil and things out of Russia and the Middle East. There may be spikes, but I think the general environment will once again be disinflationary and deflationary. And in Australia's case, if we persist with our immigration-led model, things will become very difficult indeed, because you will have cheap foreign labor pouring into the economy to drive growth, just as you're getting mass job losses out of automation. Okay, so where does that leave us? We've been, in terms of asset allocation, we've stuck with quite a bond long. We've ridden through the spikes. We've been in this particular trade for a year or so and have stuck with it. I just think that those that are arguing that the the great bond bull market is over are wrong. I'm not saying that we're into a new great bond bear market that runs forever, but I do think we're into a long period. We're going back into a period where it will be difficult to generate inflation, and so bonds still look like pretty good bet, especially when you've got the 10-year sitting up at 4%. And if you're looking out 5 years at inflation at 2%, well, that's a pretty good return for a sizable portion of your portfolio. Factor allocation at this point, look, we've been through a very, very strong rally on this sort of no landing panic over the last quarter or so, which has driven a lot of cyclicals. Personally, always thought that was temporary, so I'm not particularly enamored by cyclicals at this point. I think it's not a bad time to be in more defensives, although I would make the exception, a very large exception here on growth and AI. I think that particular area, although very expensive in certain portions, like I would avoid things like Nvidia and perhaps stocks and the semis that have already flown away. But if you consider they're the first movers in that technological revolution, the ones that will be making the stuff, but they're going to get more and more competitors, and their margins are all getting crushed, and so they're at peak values now. I wouldn't touch any of those guys, but there are sort of structural winners within people like Microsoft, Google, and whatever who will control a lot of the rollout of this AI are still very well positioned to make good returns, and they're actually not expensive in terms of bubbles, etc. They're not cheap, but they're not particularly expensive. So I'd be there. And there's services firms that will win from AI and fatty drugs. This is the second round of these kind of technological revolutions that could bring basically lift productivity a lot in these economies, and so lift earnings. And that will be particularly the case where people are the number one resource. So I'm looking at services firms as the sort of cyclical winners of the next round of the next business cycle, if you like. Finally, we're looking at some really interesting movements in resources. We're sort of back to the cyclical rallies here. Things like banks and miners, sort of late cycle winners, typically have all been rallying. I'd be quite cautious on miners. I think copper is a bubble. I watched Goldman birth this bubble, stoke this bubble, raise this bubble, and now release it on the world. We disagree. We think that, you know, the automation of cars that's coming will mean that recycled copper will be plentiful. But so if you're riding that, by all means do so, but realize that it is a bit like cocoa. You're going to have a short-term shortage, and then you're going to have an awful lot of it before too long. And I haven't even mentioned China yet at this point. And China's still looking at ways of trying to fix its property sector. And one thing that makes a lot of sense there is that they go through a process of mass demolition of semi-built apartments. And so we might see quite a lot of recycled copper and steel coming out of that kind of policy shift. And in general, of all the economies I look at around the world, the number one economy that is in real trouble is China. So you can look at that two ways. You can buying resources in China right now. Okay, green metals are all flying on the back of China's domination of EV. As I said, we think that's a short-term phenomenon, but it's definitely a real boom coming out of China, and it is helping offset their historic property crash. But what's coming to China is they've lost the growth driver of demographics and urbanization that made them the powerhouse of the resources world for the last 20 years. It's gone. It's not coming back. And so you have to be very selective when you're thinking about what resources firms that you want to buy. We're well short on iron ore miners, for instance, and even though it's been frustratingly bouncing around, we think that there's plenty of doom to come there, not least because there's heaps more supply coming. Banks as cyclicals, they're not, you know, it depends how you see this landing. Are we in a hard landing, soft landing, or a no landing? I see it as a soft landing. So I think that this business cycle can largely transition into another without having to have too bigger accident. But as I said, the further we get into this cycle, the more the durationed out debt that corporations have been enjoying, the tighter that's going to get. And so it's going to get, you know, productivity is going to be an enormous driver in the next cycle. Everyone's going to need productivity because their debt costs are going to rise because they can't get any lower, basically. And so things like banks, I mean, if you want to buy Aussie banks, buy Aussie banks. So they're the most expensive banks in the world. They're going to get another housing cycle. Fine, but don't kid yourself that you're buying something that's good value. You're basically just buying a story on that front. And it's not really late cycle. It's not the greatest time to be buying cyclical bonds, cyclical banks. But, you know, that's where Australia is. We need to build a lot more houses. And, you know, once they start cutting interest rates, then we automatically know what happens. But with the Aussie banks, if it turns out that the neutral interest rate in Australia is as low as I think it is, which is not quite at the low inflation levels, but somewhere down there, especially as these new techs roll out, well, the banks will be in trouble. The banks will have their margins re-crushed as they did in the low inflation period. So I think banks are may get a good year or so out of them. They may be at the peak now, but the further we get into this cycle, the less inflation we have, the more we get into the new cycle of these technologies rolling out, the more cautious I would be on banks, because the more their margins are going to come under pressure. So that about wraps it up for me. Damo, I don't know if you want to add anything. Nope. So we're done. So excuse me. Thanks for listening, everybody. Apologies for our technical difficulties this week. We promise to fix them by next week.